Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. You once again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know what you've done.
Good evening, and welcome to Blog Talk Radio's scan show, Stop Child Abuse Now, number 2391. NASCA has a single purpose, and that is to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect, and we do so with only two goals. The first one is educating the public, especially as related to getting society over the taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting facts and showing child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem that affects everyone. The second is offering hope and healing through numerous paths, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. I am Linda Vitti, an advocate, counselor, and life coach from New Jersey, and I will be your host for this evening. So welcome. We encourage you to call in and be part of the panel. The number to call in is 646-595-2118. Again, that's 646-595-2118. Tonight's special guest is Tim Lennon from Tucson, Arizona. He is the president of the board of directors at SNAP, which is Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. So with that short intro, I'm going to bring him right on, and instead of reading his bio, I'm going to let him tell it. So welcome, Tim.
Yes, good afternoon, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and take questions and discuss with your audience the issues of sexual abuse, particularly of children and others that are vulnerable. I was raised in a large Irish Catholic family in the Midwest. I was sexually abused by my parish priest for several months. I was violently raped. Memories of the sexual abuse did not return for 20-some years, and memories of the violent rape took 50 years for these memories to emerge. Wow. That was about 2010.
That's pretty heavy-duty stuff that you just described. And so tell us a little about what it was like growing up for you.
Well, I grew up in Sioux City, Iowa. I was one of 12 children. It was an Irish Catholic neighborhood where most of my neighbors were Irish Catholic as well, with 6, 8, 10, 12 kids. We had a large Catholic school there, and the priest came to our elementary school and parish when I was in 7th, 8th grade. He sexually molested me, and I found out later he also sexually abused maybe 15 of my classmates.
Wow.
I did also find out that he was caught by and reported by victims, and the bishop moved him three different times to three different parishes and three different towns before he came to my parish. So my abuse could would have been stopped.
Prevented. Yeah. So when this started happening, was it a one-time thing that happened? You were molested at your elementary school as well as the attack that happened at home?
Well, the series of molestations took over a period of maybe 3 to 6 months, and this was where he would take me to a baseball game, a movie, a park, but where molestation would follow. The rape was a significant, as far as I remember, just a one-time occurrence where I could have died. I'm thankful that I did not, but I did fear for my life. Pardon me?
Were you hospitalized after that?
No. I just say that unfortunate, I don't know how graphic you want to get, but I don't want to scare anybody, but I was fortunate that, but I was fortunate that I sufficiently recovered. And basically I buried memories for decades. The molestation I remembered when I was about 43. I reported to the church, and basically they wrote me back a very dismissive, demeaning, insulting kind of letter. In their return letter, they said nothing about how can we help, or that's too bad, or we'll try to stop it. And I didn't remember the break for 50 years until I was about 60. And the organization Child USA said that the average age of victims of child sex abuse coming forward is 52. So it's quite common for other victims to take many decades for these memories to come forward. And a lot of it is, coming into your own self and having the strength, the character, and will to face these most horrific kinds of memories. But I am fortunate and that I have, and my participation in SNAP and Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests has been part of my healing path.
Mm-hmm.
I see part of it as my family, my supportive family and friends, my wife, my children. The other part is professional therapy. And the third part was participation in support groups through SNAP, something that I continue to this day.
That's great. And I totally get the repressed memories, because mine didn't come back till I was in my late 30s. And I got the same thing. Like, people are like, well, how come you didn't notice back then? How come they're just coming up now? Why? Like, people have so many questions about it, and we know about as much as they do, right? Why they came up when they came up. We were just ready, I guess, at that time.
In my case, two different things prompted memories. One is that when I first came into memories, it was prompted when I went past a cathedral in San Francisco where I lived at the time, and there was some folks protesting out front of the cathedral, talking about being sexually abused by priests. And that's when I said, so was I. And that's what sort of prompted the beginning of the memories, and got involved in a support group in San Francisco area for about 3 years. Got better and had kids. And I have twin daughters that are now 21. And
that's great.
When they turned 12, that was a prompt of the other memory revelation. In other words, it triggered or brought up of me being 12 and so violently raped. And I just could not understand how anyone could harm it. It's upsetting to think about it, but how could anybody harm a child? To me, and what happened to that is I went through severe problems of PTSD. I call them the troubles, but, you know, the depression, the anger, the anxiety, the nightmares. And again, I'm fortunate. I had my wife and my kids at 12 were very supportive, my family, my brothers and sisters. And, of course, re-engaging with therapy and re-engaging with SNAP and SNAP Network. And at that time, in 2010, I've worked with SNAP pretty much, well, full-time as a volunteer.
That's great. And, yeah, it sounds like triggers prompted those memories, which that's kind of what pushes us to get past that point where they're kind of there, but you know something's not right, but you can't figure out what it is, and then something will trigger that. So that's interesting that it happened that way for you. But we're going to go to the panel now and introduce them and then come back to your story and pick it up from where we left off. So let me first go to my co-host in Florida, Bill. Hi, Bill.
Okay,
Hi.
Thanks very much. Yeah, thanks very much, Linda. And Tim, thank you for coming on the show tonight. I've been familiar with SNAP for many, many years and am also a survivor of clergy abuse. In my case, lasted a number of years, and it was perpetrated by many people, most of them clerics. A couple of lay people were in there, too. And I, too, was raised extremely Catholic, although not in that big of a family. My extended family was huge. My father had 13 children in his family. In our family, there was just the two of us. But we were raised extremely Catholic, as were all my cousins and the whole family. And, in fact, I even was interested in being a priest at one point. And I'd already been molested by the time I went to the minor seminary. I got molested again at the minor seminary. And, you know, so it's a big part of my story. I, unlike you, had no problem remembering everything that had happened to me from the get-go. It was so horrifying, and I was wishing I could forget it. And so I turned to drugs and alcohol to soothe myself. And, you know, I sobered up and got on a healing path in my 30th year, when I was 30. So, and, you know, we're delighted to have you here with us, a member of the Nasca family, too, Tim, where we address all issues of any kind of child abuse, and we're non-denominational, of course, so we cover the spectrum of actually we're global and cover you know, every ethnic and social background and so forth, and socioeconomic backgrounds and blah blah blah, and the only thing we do is deal with child abuse and trauma, and it's prevention, intervention, and recovery. So we welcome you to this group, and we call ourselves the Nasca family, meaning that if you wish to say you belong, you belong. And we welcome you then to the Nasca family. So thanks for calling
in,
Tim.
Yes.
Thanks, Bill.
It's my pleasure to be part of this family.
We're not going
anywhere.
We're gonna... You'll always be a member. I'm sorry, Linda. Go ahead.
That's okay. That's all right. I love that part. Okay, we're going to go to Darlene in Tennessee. Hi, Darlene.
Hello. I'm here to support Rick. Tim Lennon. I'm here to support Tim tonight. I'm just trying to be here for other survivors as well, you know.
Thank you, Darlene.
Thank you.
You.
Okay, we're going to go to Val in New Jersey. Hi, Val.
Hi there. Hi, Tim. I just want to tell you that I really appreciate you being here tonight and I'm just so interested in hearing your story. And I was wondering if when your memory came back that time when you saw the protest outside of the church, I was wondering if you were in therapy already dealing with PTSD symptoms or whether that came after.
In my case, it was both. I would say that I was troubled and was in therapy previous to that. But after that point, it became more apparent as, sort of the underlying source. And as Bill mentioned, many are so troubled that memories are so hard that they're buried by, different problems or drugs or alcohol to keep them at bay. I was just oblivious, but still had the effects as interfering with my life.
Right. Well, thank you. My mom was a sexual abuse survivor, and she wouldn't talk about it, and it was never clear to me whether she did actually remember everything or not. So I really appreciate you sharing your story. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Val. Okay, we're going to go to Bobby in Florida. Hi, Bobby.
Hi. Hi. Hi, Linda. Hello, Mr. Tim. This is Bobby in Miami, Florida. Mr. Tim, I was not abused by priests. And for that matter of fact, I was not abused by rabbinical soldiers either. But I tell you, I'm very familiar with SNAP. Like Bill has been familiar with SNAP for many, many, many years. I've become familiar with SNAP since I was in Jackson Hospital here at the outpatient center. And then the same year Bill spoke in Los Angeles at your program at SNAP and on the day of September. I was here at the head of the archdiocese for the day for SNAP with September 19th, maybe, 2/19 or 2/18. I don't know which day it was. I don't think you had anything this past 2/19
right.
September SNAP here in Miami, but we did it in 18. So I'm with NASCA 4 years now. Just in March this year is 4 years. And I have to throw accolades and bouquets to Bill because I've been on the show like 5-6 nights a week for 4 years. Like obsessed. And it's a very important place. It's a very important knowledge to know and deal with other people. And the camaraderie leavens the heaviness of abuse. And I found that with NASCAR 4 years. So I really continue listening to SNAP because I think you're tomorrow night you're on SNAP, aren't you? There's a big program at SNAP tomorrow night, Wednesday night, this week. I got it a couple times in the email. There's a big thing this week, right? Wednesday night?
They have a number of different online support groups. They have national support groups on abuse by nuns, abused as adults, Lutheran Mennonists. And then each local group has an online support group. So there may be a Florida, Gene Rosenberg doing an event online. I do an online group for here in Tucson. So we have maybe 30 or 40 online groups.
30 or 40 online groups. Wow, Linda, that's a lot of people.
Yes.
Online.
A lot of survivors.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks, Bobby. We're going to get back to Tim's story. Okay, your daughters were 12, and your thoughts came back about what happened to you at 12. So take it from there.
Well, I mean, the most remarkable thing about that is a tremendous amount of grief and sadness. I was crying all the time. I was depressed. I had nightmares, you know, a lot of anxiety, occasional outbursts of anger. So I immediately sought, you know, support a family, immediately engaged with a therapist who specialized with EMDR. And EMDR
right.
therapy has been incredibly important to my healing. And the third thing is, as I mentioned, is re-engaging with SNAP and SNAP support groups. And all of those have been important to coming forward and getting through what I call the troubles. And the troubles, thankfully, only lasted maybe 3 months or so. It was quite...
Wow.
It was... quite devastating, and as I understand from more knowledgeable people, that could be common time to process all the memories and to incorporate that into who you are and part of who your life.
Sure.
So it was no longer pushing memories away or pushing memories down or trying to cover them up or hide them or deny them. It was to incorporate them in fully who I am as a human being. So no longer have the past control my future. And I believe I'm fortunate in thriving on that point.
Well, how did your family deal with you going through the healing process? It sounds like they were very supportive, huh?
Yes, my wife and kids were incredibly supportive. I think that I was incredibly fortunate, as I've spoken to other survivors whose family were not supportive. We hear from survivors that parents or family or friends saying, you know, get over it. It happened a long time ago. It was just one time.
Right.
You know, you're okay. And for boys, it's other things like, why didn't you fight back? You know, what are you, a man? Are you, girl? And for girls, of course, it was your fault. You're provocative. Even if they're little girls, it's, you know, there's all these kind of excuses to blame the victim. So I was fortunate into throwing off all that and having support of a community and family and friends and SNAP that gave me that kind of support. And that, you know, we get into something you probably know, it's not your fault. You're not alone. So those are all important things. I was very fortunate in my healing.
Absolutely. Tell us a little bit more about SNAP and how you got involved.
Well, I got involved with SNAP in two different points. One is in 95 to 98 when I first came into some memories. When I wrote to the church in 96, I said, there's things I still can't remember. They're too horrific for me to bring forward. So at some point I knew that there was more. But I got involved with SNAP and the support groups, and my wife and I had been together for 10 years. We decided to have kids, and I dropped out of SNAP at that point. And then in 2010, when I was just knocked over with the repercussions of these memories coming forward and how much harm it's caused me throughout my life, I got reengaged with SNAP. And I had recently retired, and began working with SNAP in kind of an administrative position, volunteer position, as doing correspondence for people that wrote to SNAP. And so I got very engaged with them, and then I became part of the board in 2011 and been on the board ever since then. SNAP itself is a peer network. It's sort of based on AA in this respect, is we all come in as individuals. We don't come in as experts, even though we may have, very accomplished people or very accomplished therapists. Everybody comes in as a peer, as equals, and we have a support group. We have ground rules based on mutual respect and, confidentiality. And we have SNAP was formed about 30 years ago, about 1988, by Barbara Blaine, that developed into dozens of support groups and then grew into a national network. After 2002, it took on even more prominence with the dramatic expansion of awareness about sexual abuse within the Catholic community, and have been growing at, 8 to 10% every year ever since. We have 160 what we call local leaders through most of the states in the United States, and I think 8 countries internationally. We count within our network of 30,000 of survivors and supporters. These are our contacts. So, for instance, after the Pennsylvania grand jury in August of 2018, we said there should be a grand jury, there should be a state investigation in every state, and that everybody should write their state attorney general and demand, ask for an investigation. And as of today, there's 25 states that have done so. Most of our work is, in peer support, answering phone calls. We do have a national answering machine. It's not really a hotline because we don't do it 24 hours a day. But our local leaders take the calls and do the support groups. And as I mentioned, we have some national support groups. But we also intervene in the issues around our abuse and preventing abuse. In other words, we have a long history of standing in front of a church saying that they need to protect children, that they need to remove the abusers. And we have done things internationally with the International Criminal Court, the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child, and the UN Committee on Torture. But again, our principal work is support of survivors, prevent abuse, advocate for a safer community.
Right. Okay. That's a great description and a great time to let us go back to the panel and see if they have any questions for you. So first we'll go to Bill in Florida.
Well, thanks a lot, Linda. Tim, I think EMDR can be a really great tool, and we do talk about that. Of course, we talk about all the different, possible paths to recovery here at NASCA and all the abuses, too. So whether it's violent or sexual or emotional or through neglect, we have members who have experienced all these things. But EMDR as a tool, became popular not too long ago, and for some people it works like the best thing since sliced bread, and very quickly, frankly. And others, they don't get a lot out of it, but it's like any other therapy. Sometimes you got to try a lot of different paths to find the one that does work for you. So it might be ministry,
right.
It might be a life coach, it might be a group setting. In fact, I think it's best to have you know, sort of a counselor of some sort, a confidant at least, and a group. I mean, those two things combined really are dynamic. But whatever it is, EMDR, for anyone who's listening and doesn't know, is done by a licensed person, and it's a non-invasive process, so there's no pain involved or anything like that. And as I say, for some people, really just a few sessions has a remarkable outcome, and for others, it's not very effective. But just sort of like hypnosis might be for some people, or, you know what I mean? It depends on the person. But, I'm glad to hear that you did do it and had good effect on your case, obviously. Also, I knew Barbara, of course, years ago, and she's no longer with us, but, you know, I've been following, and I guess I've been a member of SNAP for years. My case continues against the church. I was violated in Pennsylvania, among other places, so I was watching what happened in Pennsylvania very carefully, also New York State, and also Maryland, and some other places, but those were the three primary places for me. So any activity that happens in those three, you know, are pertinent to me. And so I'm really glad to see the effect that's going on with we survivors who speak out, write out, you know, show up, do the demonstrations, and whatever's needed, you know, to raise the awareness. Half of our mission, frankly, is to educate the public. And, of course, the other half is, like you say, to support each other. And we are also a peer-to-peer type thing where everybody's on the same level. So I really appreciate your being here and explaining SNAP and your story, of course. And I'll wait till the next round to make more comments. You can respond back, by the way, to any panelist if you wish. That's up to you.
No, I'm a big fan of EMDR, and like you, I've heard stories of folks that have not gained it. But, you know, I do a lot of media, and people say, well, you're courageous. And I think, no, the only time I was really, really courageous was going through EMDR because it calls forth the most horrific of horrific memories. And if there are horrific memories, you bring that forward so it becomes part of who you are, part of your life, not something you bury or hide. Because emotionally, your memories are always going to affect who you are. And no matter how you push them down, they're still going to have an effect. But by bringing them forward, they become part of your life experience, and you have a better ability to deal with it.
Yes. Yeah, well said. Thank you again for being here. Go ahead, Linda.
And EMDR is a great therapy. And just as an example, like it worked great for you, Tim, and that's awesome. And I actually tried it to find out whether I wanted to, you know, learn it as a counselor. And I went through it, and I didn't really get much out of it. I learned how to do it, but I didn't really get much out of it. So I've seen that difference in clients. Some clients get a lot out of it and some don't. So it really just depends on the person and the issues, I think, and how they respond to it. But anyway, we're going to go to Darlene in Tennessee. Darlene.
Hello. I just want to thank you for sharing your story. I'm not sure whether you were on here before, but I remember so much about SNAP, you know, I don't know that much about the clergy, except for what I've been reading on the news and hearing on here at NASCA. So I'm up to learning more about it.
Well, one interesting thing, if I may jump in, that SNAP has changed over the years. And originally we started out just within the Catholic community. But going on maybe 5 years ago, we have included, involved all the different forms of religious and institutional abuse. In other words, we have communities of Baptists, Mennonites, Lutherans, and they are part, we have specific support groups for the Mennonites and the Lutherans, and we'll be doing more with the Baptists in the near future. So it's not just Catholic anymore. The SNAP has included in its network. And there's a description of the different groups, you know, on our snapnetwork.org website for more information on that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I went to SNAP earlier today, you know, when I think that you were coming in and I read your profile. And I wanted to learn more. And so I enjoy learning as much. And I get more, you know, with talking with somebody hand, you know, one-on-one than I can by the reading, you know, because you feel more personable with you, if that makes sense.
Yeah, more connection. You bet.
Right.
Absolutely.
So kudos to you.
I am so glad to hear that SNAP is doing it with other organizations, other religions, because I've seen it in the Baptist church. I've seen it in the Catholic church. I've seen it. I mean, it's not any denomination. It happens everywhere, unfortunately. And thank God for organizations like us and like you. So NASCA and SNAP is where we go. So let us go to Val in New Jersey. Hi, Val.
Hi. Thank you, Tim. I don't want to be repetitious, but I do have an EMDR question. And my question is, do you have to have your memory recall, your memory restored to go through that treatment, or does that treatment help you with recall?
Yeah, Val, I think that's both. In other words, you always start at one point and through the process. And the other thing is that the recovery of memories is not either a smooth process or a quick or an easy process. And it can take a while for the complete memories to emerge. So EMDR or even talk therapy of one form or another may be helpful in bringing memories forward. So it's not like a one step that this will bring memories forward. In my case, when I came into memories, they were not even pretty overwhelming. They were overwhelming. I was a mess. And so in that respect, most of my memories, you know, at that point had come forward over a process of time. I wrote, for those that may be interested, is that there's a blog. I have a blog. It's called standupspeakup.org, standupspeakup.org. And in there, it has my story. It has a lot of documents. But one of the documents is how to research an abuser. So recovering memories also depends. It is not just an individual thing. It's a community happening or experience. So if you involve your family in developing contacts and connections to find out, you know, their impressions, their memories, to contact classmates to find out more. So all of these sort of build upon each other. It's sort of like a weaving. You have a number of threads that you do have. You know that there's other threads you can sort of weave your memories by all these different kinds of community experiences that mm-hmm. will set a framework for more memories to come forward. And obviously, the more support you get, the more comfortable you get, the stronger you get. You know, people are afraid. I mean, I remember I was very, very afraid of my memories, very afraid. It's going to make me cry mm-hmm. just thinking about how afraid I was of memories. But if you have family, friends, or therapists, or a support group that give you that, where you feel strong, where you feel confident, where you think you have strength of will, then it provides an environment where memories can come forward. But if there's a great amount of fear, which is an emotional response, it's not intellectual, it's a very emotional kind of a response. So if there's a lot of fear about what these memories are and the harm that it's done to you, then those memories will probably be held down. I'm not a therapist. I don't want to jump into their field, but I was fortunate, as I mentioned. I had incredible support from family, from my therapist, from SNAP. And so, that weaving of community experience, gave me the strength to face. To face some very, very horrific memories.
Right. Now, I'm wondering about your family of origin.
Yes.
Does your memory include memories of you talking to anyone, or were you able to talk to anyone at all when you were a child, or not until your memories came back?
Yeah, that provides a couple of interesting stories. I grew up in a very conservative Irish Catholic family, very Irish Catholic community. And at the time, I told no one. I froze. So now I see myself as where as a child I froze, now I'm fighting back. But at the time, I was abused. In fact, this priest took me one time to a movie with another kid, a classmate, and he would abuse us both in the movie theater. But we never talked about it. And on two occasions, the priest that molested me, took me to two different priests to confess my sins. So, he was a sick piece of shit. So, I was a kid. I was just like deer in the headlights kind of response. Mm. So I didn't say anything, didn't do anything. One time, he came over to the house. Take me to the park, take me to a baseball game, take me to a movie, whatever. And I remember I went to hide. But I was in a very large family, and one of my younger brothers went looking for me and said, Tim's down in the basement. I was hiding. So I knew, it wasn't good, but I never said anything. And sex, talking about sex, and of course I didn't even know that it was sex. I mean, it was violence of the first order. But we didn't talk about those things in this family. You know, that was not what people talked about.
Right. Well, thank you for sharing that.
Great questions, Val. Very good questions. Okay, we're going to go to Bobby in Florida. Hi, Bobby.
Well, when am I in, you can hear me talking?
Yep.
Well, Hello, Kim. You know, the conversation you just finished about bringing memories up from history and living with them today, you know, that's exactly what I've done. And I know that relatives of mine, they bring up these memories. And in various ways. And I know what they're referring to. But because I brought them such current status, I live with them, and I've been talking with them 4 years in NASCA, that, you know, I pass way past them, and they're left in left field with all these memories of past abuse of me or whatever. It just doesn't even, I don't know. So what I want to say, the question is, I made this statement to you, that I understand about the abuse living in the current moment. What about if you classify the abusers as a cult, keeping your mind in their, you know, proprietary space? Just like I've come to think of, you know, I was abused, neglected to such a degree that my mind was always there, the youngster. I tried to go places and elsewhere, but I always was stuck there. You know, there wasn't, even extracurricular activities I didn't get involved with because it took me out of the mindset of the house. I always went back to the house, and I was always there waiting. I'm not going to say waiting for the abuse, but, you know, what I'm saying is I was always there, and just recently, it hasn't been really a long time now, thinking, you know, when they talk about cults and it comes on the subject once in a while, I'm saying, you know, it's the same aura. When they abuse you, they keep you there. Don't allow you to go elsewhere. It's just exactly how cults work. And you wouldn't call it a cult, a family, but in all intents and purposes, it is a cult. They want you there. And I've been defining cults the last, three months. So far, and you're sitting here and looking at the four walls and the kitchen table, and you're cooking and, you know, you're eating, and I'm on NASCAR all the time, and other places. I think, you know, I put in perspective what these abuses, where they come from. Now, what do you think of what I'm aiming at my conversation?
Yes, yeah, no? Well, okay. Yeah, Bobby, I think there's a couple of ways to look at it. Is, you know, whether these religious organizations are considered a cult or a religion, and I don't mean to be flippant, but is there material to me? I don't care. If they abuse children, they should be in jail.
Mm-hmm.
And however we identify them is fine. I'm, you know, survivors come forward like you that say, you know, the church and those horrible, horrific actions are symptomatic of being a cult. Well, and some don't. I don't get into those kind of identifiers, because to me it's immaterial. Now, I also know, so that's one comment, is put them in jail. That's my view, or however they are. The second thing is that there is within a number of religions, not only Catholic, but for instance in the Catholic, where there's been very ritualized abuse, where they've taken children and had stations of the cross, or, in Pennsylvania grand jury pointed out there's a group of priests that would identify their victims with, you know, a gold cross that they gave them. You know, that there would be different kinds of ceremonies. So in some respects, there are, you know, deviations from the mainline church within Catholic that you could call cult, because they have all these rituals outside of that mainstream. And in fact, within SNAP, there's a national online support group for ritual abuse, for those that have experienced, you know, ritual abuse. So there is overlap between the two of them. But in general, to me, it's sort of like, put them in jail, put them in jail.
I'm with you, Tim. I'm with you. Well, thank you, Bobby. And so, Tim, we have about a little over a half hour left, about 35 minutes. So I'm going to give the mic to you. Is there anything you want to talk about, or do you want me to leave the mics open and you get more questions? How do you want to do it?
Well, there's a couple of things that I would just like to mention. And one of the things that, one thing is that for children, we need to be aware that all this downtime, home time, can provide increased risk to threatened children.
Yes.
And so that we need to be aware of that and do all we can to mitigate that kind of harm to children, because the sexual abuse within the home is, I don't know what the statistics are, but it's dramatic, and there needs to be an awareness of that. And we also need to be aware that the principal means for children to come forward relaying this abuse is through schools, through their teacher or through counselors, mm-hmm. or whatever. And they don't have that kind of option. And children don't know about child protective agencies or thinking of the police or anything like that. And they may not have any kind of options. So it's an area that all of us advocates and activists need to be aware of, and to make sure that the community is aware of that, that within our own families of cousins, nieces, nephews, neighbors, whatever, that we keep this awareness alive. So I think that's just my current kind of issue that I think all of us need to be aware of, and ask the audience to take up that kind of awareness. In my own work, with SNAP, has been an increasing awareness that the NASCA and SNAP and Brain and Darkness to Light and Together We Heal and dozens of other organizations that we are in fact a movement, that there's a movement emerging similar to and equal to the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, the women's movement, gay liberation movement, the environmental movement. In other words, we've seen that with the awareness raised by the case, not only within the Catholic Church, but Sandusky, Bill Cosby, the gymnast, when gymnast steps forward, 500 followers. The silence breakers, the one actress steps forward and 500 follow, the Me Too movement, abuse within the military, abuse within the Boy Scouts. So we see that in the emergence of and consolidation of what started out as rape crisis centers now have become coalitions against sexual abuse, CASAs, all over the United States. We've seen national associations dealing with sexual abuse. And at this point, we aren't identified as a movement. We're emerging as a movement. And it's survivors stepping forward, like NASCA, like SNAP, where survivors step forward and tell their story. No longer are survivors going to be at the back of the bus. No longer are we going to be keeping silent. That the ubiquity of sexual abuse within our society needs to change. And it's not just a change in culture, but it's a change in language. It's a change in laws. It's a change of how we relate to one another. And I believe that we're seeing more and more that there's common unity between those abused as children, such as NASCA or Child Help or Child USA, but also the adults that are sexually abused, whether they're the gymnasts or those in the military. It's not only those that are abused in faith communities, but in the home, in our schools, in our athletic teams. So all of these have a common interest that when the movement as a whole succeed, each individual group succeed, or each individual person, and vice versa. When any organization like NASCA or SNAP or Darkness to Light or whatever succeeds, you know, the movement as a whole succeeds. And we saw that in the civil rights movement, not everybody agreed, not everybody had the same program or the same initiatives, the same agenda, the same goals. But within the common theme, we could see that they were, in fact, a movement. And so I am kind of advocating that that we need to move forward this idea of a movement, that we, all of us, can gain by that identity and establish that kind of concept where we, each individual organization, do our work, but also see the connection of our work with all the other organizations. And I would love to see a Congress of organizations dealing with sexual abuse to meet, to develop those kind of links and connections where we function for the benefit of the movement as a whole, and obviously for the benefit of, you know, those that are vulnerable, especially our children. So that's one of my current kinds of projects or interests, is I want to promote this understanding, acceptance of a movement for respect and dignity.
I love that. I love that. Mm-hmm. No, go ahead. I didn't want to interrupt. Keep going. That's a great concept.
Yeah,
Bill,
and,
might want to say something on that. What do you think, Bill?
Well, that's why NASCA was formed the way it was formed. So it's really a principle at NASCA that we include all those things you mentioned. In fact, members and even leaders of all those groups, like yourself, Tim, have become members of NASCA too, because we don't see this as a separate thing. We see this as a unifying thing. And we,
right.
You know, the effort here is to be as inclusive as possible, and it always has been and always will be. So we include military rapes, and we include even some domestic violence issues, especially when there's children in the home. And we include, you know, the gymnasts and the discussion of the Me Too movement. We have our own hashtag, which is Me Too CSA, childhood sexual abuse, but it's the same movement, you know. You know, we're all for cooperating with anyone while we don't belong to anyone. We don't belong to anybody, nor are we supported by anyone, but we promote everybody and we cooperate with everybody. when it's, you know, for the benefit of the child that's being abused today or the adult survivor, either one, or the general public. And that's a really important thing that I need to get in here is that the general public, you know, the whole point of these movements when they become movements is that they have enough oomph behind them to be inclusive of a significant portion of the general public. So the civil rights movement was a civil rights movement for a long time before it earned sort of the support of more and more and more general people who were not, for example, in terms of black and white, they weren't black. But they saw that they were white or they were other, you know, communities. But they saw the value of having a civil rights movement. So they, as white people, supported the black movement. It was a black movement, but it became a homogenous movement, right? It became a rainbow coalition eventually. So I see us like in the gay and lesbian community, you know, they've recently made great strides. And it was very recent that this happened. That's where I think we're poised, except we aren't as coordinated as we could be. But there are various communities around the country, like you're saying, Tim, and various many individuals who are coming kind of out of the closet of their abuse and talking publicly, which is what happened in the gay and lesbian community. And, you know, we absolutely have to see ourselves as a movement. I've been saying this for years. and that's when we'll have an effect. We'll turn the next corner, in other words, you know, when we collect enough support from the regular society and cooperate with each other, we will make a huge dent in the statistics, which I know the statistics, they're not, you know, they're astonishing to anybody who's not familiar with them. In fact, that's a great way to attract, you know, people to your side because they don't know that 60% of people that are abused, it happens in their own family or extended family, you know, and 30-something percent in what I call the caregiver community, which does include ministers and priests, but it also includes teachers and Boy Scout masters, as you mentioned. We've had them on, you know, and camp counselors. That was my first abuse, was a Catholic camp counselor. And it wasn't a parish priest, it was a camp counselor. But he was a brother. He was a cleric. And it went on from there. But anyway, the point is, I love hearing people talk about this should be a movement. And I have to say, Linda, I'm a little remiss at not using this platform we have here to say it a little more often than I used to say. I used to say it a lot more often than I do today. But anything we can do as a collective, I'm all for it, and NASCA will always support it.
Well, I want to jump in with one action that happened in 2018 is we established what we call the All Survivors Day. In other words, it was a day to celebrate survivors stepping forward and speaking up. And there's a website, of course, allsurvivorsday.org. And there was a beginning core of maybe 25, 30 organizations that came together, and we had 30 demonstrations in, I think, 6 countries. But the idea, again, was for survivors stepping forward, that no longer are we going to be silent, that we have a common interest in raising this issue, making it an issue, a community topic. It's not a topic that is... you know, that should be discouraged or hushed up or be embarrassed about, but in fact, something that we need to have as an everyday conversation that is becomes part of our discussion in day-to-day life within the family, within the schools, within the church. And obviously that doesn't happen yet. So that's why I think we need to not only change our organizational forms and making connections with each other, but also we need to change the language. We need to change how we relate to each other, provide that freedom and opportunity for that brave gymnast to step forward for the first time to name horrific abuse that has affected at least 500 that we know of. So I'm a strong advocate of of building these kinds of links and connections, of talking about changing the culture and encouraging survivors, especially within this peer framework that we both share, of telling their stories. You know, there's a tremendous amount of power in the Tarana Burke's wonderful meme, the Me Too movement, provided an opportunity for victims of sexual abuse to say, Me Too. Any Twitter post that I do, I always put Me Too. So these are effective ways for us to step forward, make it less of a hidden topic within our culture. So to me, we need to change the culture as well as building these connections.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Can I just make one criticism, okay? Because this is going to be constructive, I hope, to Tim.
Good.
We were a part of the All Survivors Day movement, gladly so. We donated to it. In fact, we rarely donate our own money. We don't have money. But we did money to the cause. And I was the coordinator, one of the coordinators for the Los Angeles group that met and so forth. So we sent people to Philadelphia. We sent people to Miami. NASCA is well represented in a variety of these places. The point I'm making, though, is that, you know, it was unfortunate that my criticism before the event was held wasn't heard or wasn't followed. And it was that it became too well known as a snap event. And that was a mistake, I felt. I felt before it was held that it should be, you know, no email should be going out from snap. It should be going out from AllSurvivorsDay.org or whatever, because it put an imprimatur on it that it was about, and that's in fact what happened. So you know, that's, I am all for an All Survivors Day, and that's why I liked the name, because it's about all of us together, and it was a unique name. I hope we continue to use it, but again, I hope that you can hear, you know, what I'm saying tonight. I think that was part of the problem, that we haven't had more, made more juice out of it. Let's put it that way.
All right. I would agree.
Okay. We're going to go to
sorry, Linda.
Two other
I had
panelists.
To make that comment, though. Sorry, Linda. Thank you.
That's okay.
No, no.
I hear you. It's got to be said. But Val's been holding over 20 minutes, so we're going to go to her in New Jersey. Hi, Val.
Hi. I have a couple of thoughts. One is I just really, really appreciate, I really appreciate you turning your pain into a purpose and doing what you're doing. I really do. My mom would have benefited so much from all these things, just being able to maybe recognize the source of her trauma, which she just didn't ever connect, and she suffered immensely, and she didn't understand her rage and all the things that she brought forward into my life. She just didn't understand, and people didn't talk about it, and people didn't even want to indicate it. You know, there was no discussion, but I just, if I imagine what it would have been like if my mom could have found an organization like SNAP or NASCA or something where she could find her voice, it could have helped her so much. So I just really, really appreciate all that you're doing, all that you've done, all that the organization is doing. It's miraculous, really. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Val. Okay, we're going to go to Bobby in Florida. Hi, Bobby.
No.
Bobby, you're
on.
Can
you hear me now? Now you hear me speaking now.
Yes.
I don't know how to go forward in the conversation. You know, the abuse is It's just when it happens, you know, it's something you can't predict going to happen. It just seems to be these abusers just seem to take advantage of the moment. And can't see it coming. And perspective that exists, yes. But you look at the teachers and the professors and clergymen, and I'm an adult. Let's say a 15-year-old kid looks at a preacher, a professor, or a clergyman. You don't know. And even though we want to disclose it happening, it happened. Even in NASCAR we have in the front and the wall in the wallpaper we have indications of child abuse. Don't have indications of the abuser. How do you tell the person's an abuser? And yeah, they keep a distance, you know, and they don't accept gifts and don't go for outings and don't go to movies. But then listen to you, Tim, and listen to us talking NASCAR. Yeah, I was invited by the clergyman to a dinner, and he went here, we went there, and all the story you shouldn't happen. And it's happening now as we're talking. So you wonder, how do you smarten up these children? Is it just because it's always been happened? Not 2020. It happened in 1620. It happened in 1220. It happened in 820 also. How do you combat something like that, Tim? What do you think?
You want to field that, Tim?
No.
Yeah, that's a prevention area. And even NASCAR doesn't heavily involve itself in prevention. Of course, we talk about it all the time, but we usually talk about it to people who are working with children. We don't talk to the children themselves. But when you're talking about prevention, that's information you give to kids. And intervention is information you give to adults who may interact with kids, maybe parents, but maybe also teachers. And others, healthcare workers and so forth, that come in contact with children. So those two areas are really held together by other groups or individuals who have background checks and are vetted and fingerprinted and all that and licenses to work with children. SNAP is not that, and neither is NASCAR, but we do carry a lot of information, Tim, about the kinds of things you look for and what do you do when you find it. And a group like you mentioned, Darkness to Light, is an example of a group that does that work very well, and that's pretty much what their specialty is. They go around and they try to educate communities, including parents, but also just regular community members, and they'll give presentations and so forth when small groups of people ask for it. They'll come to your town and set up and do it, and it's a nominal cost. Very worth it. You get a lot of bang for your buck. But NASCAR and SNAP don't do that directly.
Yeah, I apologize, Bobby. It your question sort of sent me into my own loop of my own experience, and I got lost, so I apologize.
No need
You're
for
doing
apologies.
Fine, Tim. You're doing great.
Leave me, no need to apologize. But if I cornered you, good. All right.
Bobby will do that, I guess. All right, so I'm gonna leave. We have about less than 15 minutes left, so I'm leaving the mics open. But Tim, is there anything you want to say to the listening audience or to the panelists?
Yeah, and I would say through NASCAR, through SNAP, through RAIN, through Darkness to Light, Child Help, who have a great hotline, Child USA, who are great advocates for children, that there's help. You know, the people aren't alone. And I think that's the most important step is to make that one phone call, whether it's SNAP to NASCA, to Child Help or Child USA or RAIN. But that's the most important thing. And then SNAP, we have, I don't know, maybe 30, 40 different support groups, and we have seven or eight different national support groups with various topics. But our support groups, we don't check IDs at the door, so to speak. They're all online. It's a peer process. And if you go to snapnetwork.org, you go to locations, you can find where the nearest support group there is, or you can contact one of the leaders, and they may know resources in local areas and things like that. And I know that NASCA has a wonderful resource page that I've referred people to all the time for help when people need to make that phone call. There's help available. So I think that's really an important thing, is taking that first step. The only other thing on a personal note is that, as I mentioned previously, is I have a blog, but it's a pretty substantial undertaking, and there's a lot of resources for people coming forward as a survivor, whether it's on how to take action, about investigations, about the FBI, about my story, about survivor's wisdom, how to support a survivor, how to research an abuser. So there's a lot of different kinds of resources there, helpful organizations. So there are resources available for those seeking help or information.
That's great. Thank you. So I have all the mics open, and if anybody would like to make a final comment or say anything to Tim, feel free to go ahead.
Well, this is Bobby. Tim, this is standupspeakup.org. That's what you're referring to, your blog?
Yes.
Okay. I wrote it down.
So I would like to take this opportunity for thanking Bill and you, Linda, for you know, this opportunity to participate. I'm honored and thrilled to be here, pleased to be here. I love the discussion. I honor the work that NASCA is doing and hold NASCA in high respect, and look forward to future opportunities to connect or work together.
Absolutely.
Well,
you did a phenomenal
job. I'll speak on behalf of NASCA and say we feel the same way. We're happy to cooperate with, as I say, anybody. We have managed to do this work being all volunteers. Nobody's paid, you know, and we have no funding stream or anything like that or grants. So, but it's an amazing thing that's done because, you know, somebody mentioned the miracle before. Each one of us is a miracle, that we got to wherever we are today, and that there's still work to do on each one of us moving ahead, but that to get together as a community, we can do what we can't do individually. And that's kind of, again, conceptually, a lot of what NASCA is about. So we want to cooperate with other groups. That's why our resource pages includes them all, and, you know, and so forth. So interacting with any other group is a privilege for us too. And then I also want to report to you, Tim, this is on a personal level, Linda, so give me just a minute, that, you know,
sure.
I really think it's important that people report abuse when they get the memory or as soon as they can. They should report the abuse, even if the statute of limitations is beyond their ability to take any action. And that is because with some of the problem we have with estimating, and that's what we do, how much child abuse goes on has to do with the fact that a crime, which it's always a crime, if you sexually assault a child any time, every instance is a crime. Those crimes don't get counted in the statistics until they're reported. So even if you're in your 40s and the statutes run out 10 years ago, report the crime. And then this is what I did. And so I became a part of the statistics. And then in Pennsylvania, for example, they came close. They changed the statute, but they gave up the window of opportunity for people who are older like myself to take an action. They negotiated it away in order to pass the statute change. So I'm glad they changed the statute, but I'm still holding out the possibility that the next time they convene, they might bring up the window again. But they did that in New York. And as I mentioned earlier, I'm an abuse survivor from New York too. And so when they changed the statute and gave a one window of opportunity, I was ready because I'd already reported them. I was ready to move forward and have a civil case now against, the diocese in New York where these abuses happened in their jurisdiction. And I don't know where it'll end up, but, you know, it took me 50 years to get to that point. And I just All right. want to say, you know, the reporting is very important, and then so is, if you choose, when it's possible, moving ahead. You don't have to, but, you know, moving ahead with litigation because, again, we have to hold them accountable. Whoever our predators are, church or not, we have to hold them accountable. And, right. you know, it's kind of up to us. So that's my personal comment.
Yeah, Bill, I want to just piggyback on one point of that and reporting to the police, and I wholeheartedly support that. I'm in full agreement. And one of the benefits, one of the necessary point is when we report to the police, we're not just reporting for ourselves. We're reporting to protect other people that are, other children, other people that are vulnerable. These predators right. will abuse for decades. And if we report now, mm-hmm. we may prevent abuse somewhere else.
Exactly. Exactly. We don't do it for us. We do it for the community that we serve. Right. Even if there's no
exactly.
chance for us to get kind of our own justice, it doesn't matter. We do it for everybody. We do it for the whole community. And as they say, as these statistics get, you know, improved by actual reporting, they're going to jump up. Because, the vast majority, and let's be honest to our listeners here, the vast, vast majority of child abuse goes unreported.
Right.
Now, the Catholic mm-hmm. Church all over the country in 2002, as Tim said, you know, changed the policies and made every diocese and every order come up with a policy that they were going to, a set of principles that they were going to follow, and each one of them did that. I've been a beneficiary of that, as Tim has too, I guess, but in my case, the Benedictines and the Zavarians, two orders, they both responded. The Zavarians, because it was within the statute, even went further, and actually there's a criminal case possible and a warrant out for the arrest of one of the brothers, the original guy that molested me, because Maryland criminally doesn't have a statute of limitations. It's unlimited, in other words. And in New York, again, they couldn't do anything about it until now. And this year, between last August and this August, there is this window for anyone that's, you know, older to come forward. And it's going to close in August. So you got to act now. But you don't have to finish it now. You just have to start it now. And I've done so. So, I mean, it's going to be part of my story, wherever it ends up. But it doesn't matter where it ends up. It's also part of my story now that I want people to know you can do this, and if you feel it's appropriate, you should do it. And you certainly should report it, not for your sake necessarily or for your justice, but, you know, for the children of today, frankly.
Well, absolutely. And when it we're talking about a lot with the clergy, but when it happens in immediate families, like it did in my case, and I went to report just to protect my niece, and everybody's saying, well, no, he's older now. He's not going to do that. He won't molest now. And I actually believed that until I got more information about that. It's not about age. It's not about sex drive. It's about manipulation and control.
That's right. It's so, power.
Right. It's power. And that doesn't change. I don't care how old they are. So report, as Bill's saying. So Val or Bobby, do you have any closing statements you want to make? We have about 3 minutes left, 3 or 4 minutes.
I do. I was wondering, Tim, I was just wondering if at any point you found out whether your abuser was ever removed from his position, or you just don't know what happened with him.
Yes. In 1996, when I wrote to the church with my partial memories of the abuse, they wrote back a very dismissive letter, as I mentioned. And then their only comment was, Father Murphy is dead. That's all. But as I said, he was caught 3 times previous to coming to me. And the only reason my abuse stopped was because he got caught by another parent and they moved him again. But I saw him back in my parish watching Little League baseball games one afternoon. So even though they moved him to another town, he was still around, as a predator. So.
And I wonder, I mean, to me, I know I was trying to follow what you were saying, Bill, but just even after they die, it's so important to report the abuse so that the truth stands, whether or not it's received, but at least it's reported, whether or not they're dead, for everyone's sake.
It's also very, very important for us as survivors to fight back. And in my case, I was 12, I froze. Now I'm fighting back. So when you report to the police, when you take action, that is a tremendous boost to survivors to say, I fought back. Mm. So report them, even if it doesn't happen, within the within prosecution, a survivor can say for themselves that they fought back. A letter to the editors fighting back. Talking to a politician to make stronger laws is fighting back. That's why I work with SNAP. I'm so angry that this is my form of fighting back.
Right. It's your empowerment and part of your healing then.
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Val, in my case, I named 3 specific people, Val, in my case. One was deceased. Mm-hmm. One was removed from contact with children and could not leave the monastery alone anymore, couldn't take a car out, had to be accompanied by another priest. And one had left the order, and he's the one that has a criminal offense, a criminal warrant out for him. He lives in Southern California and he's in his 80s, so it's not likely he's going to come back to Maryland and show up to be arrested. He's not going to do that, but if he did, he would be. But in each case, the church took it seriously, and they do keep records of all the ministers in the church, brothers and priests both, and these records, regardless of whether it was an effect that could be done, went in their file. So they became a matter of record for all 3 of these men that they had credible accounts of abuse occurring by me, 4 of them. So that's never going to change. And by the way, civil cases can be brought against the diocese or the organization that the priest or brother belongs to after they're dead. It still can be a civil case. Can't be a criminal, obviously, but it can be a civil.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's so interesting. That's good.
Well, thank you all. Tim, I want to thank you so much. You did a tremendous job tonight, and we're so glad to have you on, and we look forward to having you back and being part of our NASCA family. So I'm going to give you the final word.
Well, I don't know if I have the final word, but as I mentioned previously, it's been an honor and a privilege to be here, and I've been happy to speak with you, Linda, and Bill, and our panelists, Val and Bobby. So I look forward to future opportunities to join you.
Thank you so much.
Tim. This is Linda Beattie from New Jersey. Good night and God bless. And please visit NASCA.org. Good night.
Another tomorrow, 'cause that dawn was love. You are forgotten after all that you've done.
Blog Talk Radio.